Welcome. This is a real special day for us in the statistics section. We always look forward to this day because this session is our awards session in which we have the opportunity to honor our awardees, people who have made contributions in various ways to statistics, to biostatistics, and to public health. It's a very special day, hopefully for them, because they have earned this honor, and for us, because we get the opportunity to honor them, to see them, hopefully have an opportunity to chat with them, and take away some knowledge from them and some experiences from them to help us better achieve better health for the public here in the United States and abroad. So, thank you. This is the 2007 APHA Statistics Section awards session, and we'll start it off with our first award, and that's the Spiegelman Award. And we have Francesca Dominici, who has won this award herself in the past, and she's going to come up and present the award for this year's award winner. Francesca?
So it's my pleasure to announce the award for the Spiegelman Award for 2007. And before doing that, I would like to make a few words and remark for David. David Anson is basically, as far as I know, the most productive statistician in the country. So that's very simple. I had the honor to review the application this year. As for many of you know, that if you win the award, you will be reviewing the application for the nomination for the award for the following 3 years. So I saw the application, they were really, really outstanding, but David, the productivity and the breadth in the work that he's conducting is really remarkable. So David is a senior investigator at the biostatistics branch at the NIEHS, and he's an adjunct professor both at Duke, at the Institute of Statistics and Decision Science, now becoming a Department of Statistics, I heard, and the UNC Department of Biostatistics. I was interviewing his wife 5 minutes ago, and she mentioned that there are at least 100 papers in the peer-reviewed journal, working on 2 books, one probably right now, as she's finishing this session, mentoring several postdoctoral fellows and PhD students, and David's researcher interests are really at the cutting edge of this Bayesian model for very complex data, for functional data. It's the only person, actually, I also know that can manage working on Dirichlet-Prior, and every time you present a model using Dirichlet-Prior, it looks so easy for him, and I can assure you it's not. So anyway, having said that, it's my honor and pleasure to announce the Spiegelman Award winner for 2007, David Danson. And David, come here. Okay. I didn't get a pecan salad.
Didn't get the pecan?
No.
This is Georgia pecans.
He would like to
from our incoming chair of the statistics section.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. I'd first like to thank the Spiegelman family and for setting up this award. I think for young biostatisticians who are trying to keep motivated, it's really a nice carrot. And also to look back at the past winners and how distinguished they are, it's really really nice to get this award for me. I'd also like to thank a number of people who've sort of been instrumental in my career, starting with Bets Halloran at Emory University, who was my advisor. She really helped me a lot by giving me the freedom to develop my own ideas, which was very important. And Claire Weinberg at NIHS has also been very important in my career, and I was initially a postdoctoral fellow with her. And a couple of individuals have had a big impact. David Banks, who nominated me for the award, and Alan Gelfand and Mike West at Duke University have really been mentors to me. And finally, I'd like to thank my wife, who's really been supportive. It's difficult having sort of two academic types doing research all the time with a family, and she's really been supportive. Thank you.
Well, like I said a minute ago, it's a very special day for the statistics section. It's also a very special day for me because I don't get an opportunity to introduce luminaries like we're going to see today very often, and it certainly is a pleasure to acknowledge their contributions. I've known some of these people for several years or decades even, in fact. I've certainly known of the other ones and have followed their careers very closely and have watched as their contributions to statistics and public health have grown over the years. And I expect, knowing these folks, even though some of them are in retirement, quote-unquote, they never do retire, and they will continue to make substantial contributions. So I hope that you'll really take advantage of seeing these folks and enjoying hearing some of the remarks today from each of these individuals. The first person that I get a chance to introduce, first of all, I'm going to take the chair's prerogative. I know these are supposed to be real short, these first three presentations, because we have featured speakers later, but I can't help but want to take a couple of minutes to talk about these three individuals that have won the section awards. These are really unique individuals who have contributed in so many ways, and you'll see that as we honor them today. This first individual's really got a special place in my heart. Mel, I've known you forever since I came to CDC, and the first person I actually recruited to CDC was through you. And I've always thought of you as a mentor and a friend and a colleague in a lot of different ways, but your contributions have just been immense to statistics, to public health, and the public health community. Mel graduated from North Carolina State with a PhD in statistics, a minor in public health from their arch rival, I think, if I'm correct, the University of North Carolina, and then embarked on an academic career where he was at the University of Missouri for 10 years, and at a very early age was director of their statistical laboratory. And that's a very difficult job, as probably all of us know. Eventually he found his way to Ohio State back in 1980 and has been there ever since, and has done innumerable jobs, and all very well from what I understand. Some of that I know firsthand. He directed the biostatistics lab there. He has been acting chair of two different divisions. That in itself is remarkable. And even after that, was named a chair. So he's acting chair, then acting chair again, and has contributed in leadership roles throughout his career at Ohio State. He was the chair of the Division of Epi and Biostatistics and has been the associate director of the Biostatistics Center, the Office of Research in the Biostatistics Center, since 1998, when it was established. Very recently, he has become professor emeritus there at Ohio State. He's retired, and hopefully will have continue to enjoy his academic life and yet still his life outside of academics. I wish you well in those endeavors, Mel. Over 130 publications, including at least one with our Amy Furcatex here today. He is a member of the usual professional societies. He has been a consultant over the years, and he has been a teacher and a mentor to numerous students over the years, and very recently became a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So that's quite an honor, Mel, and we're all very pleased for you and happy for you for that. When Stan Limichael left the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, one of the things that he did, he asked me before he left, he said, do you know anybody at Ohio State? He was going to go to Ohio State and pull a lot of the statistics programs together and try to move them in a positive direction. And I said, I do know somebody who will be a pillar of strength for you when you get there, and that's Mel Mershberger. And Stan has assured me over the 9 or so years that he's been there with you, Mel, that he has always been able to rely on you as, obviously, as a teacher and as a mentor for himself as well as for the students there, but also as a pillar of strength and somebody who can provide guidance to him and to other leaders that are there at Ohio State. So it's really a pleasure. You're one of the good guys, and I'm real happy for you to receive the Statistical Section Award in academics this year. So, Mel, come on up.
Well, as I reflected on the years, decades, as David has so indicated, the times have been very good. And when I start to think about who to thank, I would have to start with the students that I've worked with through the years, ranging from Tom Sinks, who's currently at CDC, to Amy Firkatich, who's here today, and there have been many in between. Also to colleagues and faculty, I'm reminded of when we hired Stan. It was one of the best hires I have ever made, and little did I know that he would be my boss someday as Dean of the College of Public Health at Ohio State. Many people influence your life, and I can only say that probably the one thing that I would advise young faculty and students is to work hard at the task that is before you, because you never know when the completion of that task will provide you awards such as this later in life. I know that the refereeing that I did as a young faculty member was instrumental in being selected associate editor of Biometrics, and things like that. This is just an example of how you keep at it, you work hard, and things will accumulate on your behalf. And I just want to thank the board of the American Public Health Association, the statistics section of that organization, and others who have been instrumental in making this award possible. Thank you very much.
Just for those of you who haven't seen the citation, I think there's people passing the programs around so that you can see that, but I feel like I should read that. To Mel for his contributions to survival analysis methodology with a particular focus on human health data, for fostering and developing biostatistics in public health education programs, and for his commitment to improving public health through collaborations with epidemiology, medicine, nursing, dentistry, and optometry. So thank you, Mel. Our next award is in the government. Is in the government aspects of public health and biostatistics. And that's going to go to Joe Grafer. And Joe, we really have appreciated your accomplishments as well. Joe graduated from the State University of New York in Buffalo and has since made substantial contributions to the collection, analysis, and interpretation of national survey and study data on our behalf. And that is right, on our behalf, because he has worked at the federal level, and the statistics that he has touched and analyzed and collected over the years are probably our statistics, certainly some of our statistics. He first started out at NCHS, the National Center for Health Statistics, and became a substantial contributor to Health U.S., the first round of Health U.S., as well as to the National Health Interview Survey, which many of us in public health know as a landmark survey in data that we utilize all the time. He soon moved to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, where he rose to be a branch chief for the Survey and Analysis Branch, and he was responsible for the development and conduct, among others, of the National Household Survey on Drug Abuse, as well as the Drug Abuse Warning Network. Since 1992, Joe has been at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. That is an agency in the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a sister agency to CDC and HSDR, so we're in the same department, Joe, and I've certainly marveled at your work over the years and appreciated it. He is currently a division director for the Population Survey Division, and as such, he manages all aspects of the National Household Survey on Drug Abuse. I think that's been renamed. I forget exactly the name, Joe. Well, I apologize for that. But this is the largest ongoing survey on drug use and abuse in the world. What a contribution. He's had numerous awards, and at all three of the federal agencies that he has been at, he received the Director's Award for contributions, and that's quite an accomplishment, Joe. Congratulations on those three awards. He's had numerous publications and contribution to the knowledge, particularly in the the prevalence and use and trends of drugs and drug usage throughout the United States. And as a fellow federal employee, I can't help but tell you how much I've appreciated and really do understand what you've done and the contributions that you've made for all of us in the United States on all of your accomplishments there at those federal agencies. Let me read the citation for you, and then I'd like for you to come up as well. This is for promoting and maintaining methodological rigor in producing objective, accurate, and timely estimates of alcohol, tobacco, and illicit drug use in the individual states, as well as in the nation, and for helping improve state-level and federal planning for effective prevention and treatment programs. Joe, congratulations. We appreciate you, and come on up.
Prepare any kind of a speech, so let me just say it's been an honor to have worked for the federal government for 31 years now. It's been rewarding for me, the feeling of serving the public and providing data for all the people that ask for it and need it and use it. It's a little optimistic to say that it's always used for all the policy decisions, but we try to get it into that. Well, I'd like to thank all the people I've worked with over the years, all the supervisors I've had that I've learned from, and all the great staff that have worked for me. And I'll also thank my family, my wife Sue, and my daughter Rachel for putting up with my emailing all evening long and writing papers all weekend long, even though it's not supposed to be work time. So thanks a lot, and thanks to the statistics section for giving me the award.
Okay. Our next award is in the industry category, and this was a very difficult award to get this year because for Dr. Peace, and the reason is because he's so deserving in several of the different categories. But we decided that it would be for the industry contributions this year. But I will mention some of your other contributions as well, Dr. Peace. You've been contributed in so many ways to statistics and public health, and I hope all of the audience will appreciate it as much as I do what all you've brought to the table for everybody. Dr. Peace graduated from Georgia Southern College with a BS in chemistry, and he had a very strong desire to continue his education, and he was able to do so. He received his master's degree from Clemson University. He received a Ph.D. in biostatistics, Medical College of Virginia, and Virginia Commonwealth University. So that was, as you can see, a very nice set of degrees that prepared him well for all he's accomplished, which is just an amazing career. His first career was in teaching, and he was a researcher, and he was at several universities. He was at Georgia Southern College, also one of my alma maters, so I certainly have appreciated that. He was also at Clemson University, at Virginia Commonwealth University, and at Randolph-Macon College. He was a tenured professor there, and that was his first career, which is, you know, a career for almost anybody else, but not Dr. Peace. So he embarked on his second career. His second career in research and in management in the pharmaceutical industry, where he rose very quickly to be a senior statistician at all of the major players in the pharmaceutical industry, such as at Burroughs Wellcome, at A.H. Robbins, at Smith Kline, at G.D. Searle. He was vice president of the worldwide technology operations at Warner Lambert in Park Davis. And it's just an amazing, amazing all of the different places and places that you've made contributions. He founded the Biopharmaceutical Research Consultants Incorporated group, which has continued to make major contributions and work with the pharmaceutical companies and FDA and others in order to try to bring to us a way to achieve better health. And this is something that's always been in Carl's background from the time he was a little one through his early years and through Georgia Southern. He's always maintained a commitment to public health and wanting to bring public health to the people. And you'll see that as I continue here. In his pharmaceutical life, he made pivotal contributions in the development approval of drugs for various maladies, such as treatment for Alzheimer's disease, treatment to reduce the risk of myocardial infarctions, treatment for hypertension and arthritis, treatment for anxiety, depression, panic attacks, and prevention and treatment for gastrointestinal ulcers. So, I mean, he's touched a lot of different places, and again, a lot of places that touch us. So we're very fortunate to have him have undertaken that second career. He was the founder of the Biopharmaceutical Applied Statistics Symposium, BASS, in 1994. And in fact, we thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and visit with us today, Carl. BASS is having their annual meeting in Savannah this week, and Dr. Peace made special arrangements to fly up and join us today, and so we are very, very pleased that you were able to do so. BASS is a forum. It is an opportunity for biopharmaceutical professionals to share insight into the biopharmaceutical problems that they face on a daily basis. And I can't help but think that this latter piece is so important, and a lot of times we overlook how important it is, but not Dr. Peace. BASS has been a source of funding to support graduate work in biostatistics, and he has ensured that the income from BASS has supported up to now at least 25 graduate students who have received degrees, MPH degrees, MDs and PhDs at the Medical College of Virginia and at Georgia Southern. And we have really appreciated those kind of contributions that sometimes go unnoticed. But surely we know how it affects all of our young people and the future of biostatistics and hopefully public health. So thank you for that. He's received numerous awards, so many I certainly can't give them the respect that they deserve, but he has been the recipient of the Star and the Featured Alumnus Award of the Medical College of Virginia. He has received the Alumnus of the Year Award from the Alan Paulson College of Science and Technology at Georgia Southern. And I'm sure I can say this for you, that you are particularly proud of being the first recipient of the Presidential Medal for Outstanding and Meritorious Contributions to Georgia Southern University. As a Georgia Southern alumnus, I'm certainly proud of that award for you. He's had several awards from the Southwest Georgia Cancer Coalition, and other awards too numerous to name, but all very important because of his dedication. He's the founding editor of the Journal of Biopharmaceutical Statistics, and has been editor for years. Over 150 publications, has been involved in all of the professional societies that you would think, plus more, many editorships, and he has embarked on his third career now. And maybe it's a return a little bit to his first career, but I like to look at it as actually a new venture in and commitment to the public health of people in South Georgia from where he rose, and he has never forgotten his roots there, and he's always made a commitment that he wanted to address health problems of rural and underserved populations in Georgia and throughout the region. And what Dr. Peace has done over these last few years in combination with Georgia Southern and with the people of South Georgia and with all of the networks of friends and colleagues that he's made throughout the years is astonishing for it to have occurred in such a short time. He has helped establish the Jinping Su College of Public Health at Georgia Southern College, Georgia Southern University. It was Georgia Southern College when I was there, at Georgia Southern University. And this is the first school of public health in the state of Georgia system. And so that was quite a remarkable accomplishment. And I haven't talked with him about all of the different obstacles that he and Georgia Southern faced. I know there were many and varied, but because of Dr. Peace's commitment and because of Georgia Southern's commitment, and I see several people here from Georgia Southern, and I certainly salute you and your partnership with Dr. Peace in order to make things happen down there for the school and for the people who are underserved down there. Something that I know Dr. Peace probably wouldn't even want me to mention, but I can't help but mention it. It's so striking. He is a philanthropist. He is truly a philanthropist. He has created endowments more than I could even dream of thinking about. He has endowed Georgia Southern University with lots of dollars in order to create the Jinping Su School of Public Health, now the College of Public Health. He has created the Carl E. Peace Chair in Biostatistics through his donations. He has created graduate scholarships in biostatistics for Georgia Southern students. He has created the Bass Scholarship in biostatistics. He has two endowments to create scholarships in biostatistics for students from his home, Baker County. And you'd think, my goodness, this is just overwhelming. Well, it goes on and on. He has created three endowments at the Medical College of Virginia, two endowments at the University of California, Berkeley, including for the Jinping Su Carl E. Peace Chair in Biostatistics. Can you imagine having two chairs, being able to endow two universities with chairs of departments? Carl, you're amazing. But again, he's never forgotten his roots. And I must tell you, this is really moving for me to think about. But when you think about what you can do in biostatistics, think outside the box and think of Carl Peace, because that's what he has done. He has epitomized what we in biostatistics should aspire to do to make a difference. He's a true philanthropist, and it's a great honor, Dr. Peace, to present you with this token of appreciation for statistics, for biostatistics, and for public health. Thank you for everything that you've done.
Thanks very much, David. I, too, did not plan to make a speech, but I asked a few minutes before the session began if we were expected to say anything, and David said, just say what you like. So taking a cue from the previous awardees, I'd like to thank, starting with my mother, then my high school math teacher and principal, who largely were responsible for being able for me to get to college. The high school principal helped me sign a note with a businessman to borrow $532 to prepay my first quarter off a school at Georgia Teachers College when I began, and thereafter I was able to get scholarships. So those three individuals I owe a lot to. I also owe a lot to the people who gave me jobs in the pharmaceutical industry and at the various universities, because truly it's been very rewarding for me, because I like to work, I like to think, I like to contribute. And so I should end by thanking Dave, Martin, and Amy for their support of me for this particular award. I receive it on the behalf of the Jinping Su College of Public Health and Georgia Southern University with a lot of pride. Thank you very much.
And his award reads as follows. For his leadership in philanthropy and his unstinting, selfless service in developing and overseeing biostatistics and public health educational and outreach programs, particularly the Biopharmaceutical Applied Statistics Symposium, which he founded and then chaired for 14 years. Thank you, Carl. Okay. Well, this has been a lot of fun for me, and the fun's still not over because I really get to introduce a person I hope I can call a friend, somebody who I've known for a couple of decades and certainly have admired from afar for his substantial contributions to public health. This is the Lowell Reed Lecture, and we're going to be honored to have Dr. Scott Zeger present it in a minute. As many of you know, Lowell Reed was a groundbreaker in biostatistics. Not only was he a professor in biostatistics, he was the chair of the biostatistics program at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He became that chair, I think, in 1926. He made several contributions, including the ED50 terminology. He worked with Wade Frost in order to develop the epidemiologic model that we all in biostatistics have to be at least familiar with. Dr. Reed became a dean and then the president of Johns Hopkins University. And our award each year, or our ability to select a lecturer each year, celebrates Dr. Reed. And each year the section then honors this individual who contributes to the field of statistics and public health statistics through contributions in research and in teaching and in servicing and in mentoring. And I can't think of anyone more deserving than this, and we really hit the jackpot this year because Dr. Zeger has followed in many ways in Lowell Reed's footsteps, a professor at Johns Hopkins, a chair of the department, a dean, a person who has made such substantial contributions in public health and in biostatistics that we all are familiar with, or will be when I remind you if you have not put the two and two together lately. But Scott received his BA in biology from the University of Pennsylvania and his PhD from in statistics from Princeton University, and he's been at Johns Hopkins for many years. He's a fellow of the American Statistical Association, and like Mel, a fellow of the American Association for Advancement of Science. Quite a contribution that scientists throughout the United States would honor one of ours, one of our statisticians, one of our biostatisticians. So congratulations on that. He's also an elected member in the National Academy of Sciences in the Institute of Medicine, and that's quite another accomplishment that goes beyond statistics and biostatistics for his critical scientific thinking and contributions. For those of you who haven't put the two and two together, he's best known for his groundbreaking and impactful development of the generalized estimating equations with his friend and colleague there at Johns Hopkins, Kung Yi Liang. This analysis, this GEE analysis, the methods are for analysis of data from longitudinal, from time series, from genomic and other types of studies that produce correlated responses. And truly, if you think back over the last probably 30 years in statistics, it's got to be at the top of the new statistic methods that have contributed so mightily to our fight of in public health. So, Scott, that's a wonderful contribution, and we all have are in gratitude to you and Kung Yi for that. He has received the Snedeker Award for the best paper in biometry, that for the GEE method that he developed. He's received our Spiegelman Award here in at APHA in the past, two different years, and I know that he's very proud of this because as an academician, you not only have to do research and do your administrative part, but you have to teach. And I would certainly be proud of these awards. He, in two different years, has received the Golden Apple Award from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health Student Assembly for excellence in teaching. That's a very high award, the highest that students can give you. So that's amazing, but I'm not surprised. numerous publications for his varied and substantial contributions in biostatistics and public health, notably in environmental epidemiology. Many of you are probably familiar with his work for quantifying health effects of smoking and air pollution. He's also served as a statistical expert for the U.S. Justice Department in several states in suits against the tobacco industry on our behalf. And of course, he's made numerous contributions in clinical research as well. However, when you stop to think about contributions, sometimes you have to put numbers on it and quantify things. And I think one of the best ways to do that is to demonstrate the impact that you have in citations. And Scott, you've been amazing. You have been named one of the top 25 most cited mathematical scientists of the past decade. That's an amazing accomplishment. And we're proud of you for that, and we've benefited greatly from that, Scott. So it's really, truly a pleasure for me to introduce the Lowell Reed Lecturer for 2007. I know that Dr. Reed, should he be here, would say what a great choice, somebody who is an exemplary selection. And the title of his talk today is Biostatistics, Reflections on What Lowell Reed Might Have Thought About, Where Biostatistics Is, and Where It Is Headed. Dr. Zeger.
If I'd known my mother was going to write that introduction, I would have invited her to do it. Anyway, it's a great pleasure, and I do have Lowell Reed with me today, actually. I brought an old movie that I found of him, and hopefully we'll be able to look at it together if we can make this work. So, you've already seen, there's some pictures that are missing here. Unfortunately, I use a Mac, and there's a rule about using Macs. Don't bring Mac things to places like this. But just a little bit of history about Lowell Reed, and then I have some quotes from him that I thought I would use to give you a sense of how he looked at the world. He was from Maine. He was a real New England gentleman, and graduated in 1907 with a bachelor's degree from there, and then a PhD in mathematics from the University of Pennsylvania in 1915, and he was recruited to Johns Hopkins in 1918 to be one of the first faculty members in what I think is America's first Department of Statistical Science in 1918. He became the chair in 1925. He became dean of the School of Public Health in 37, head of the Johns Hopkins Hospital and Medical School in 1946, and then president of the university in 1953, and by that time he was just plumb worn out, as they say in southern Georgia. So he made lots of contributions in statistics, the early development of statistics, and he was a disciple of Raymond Pearl, who was a biologist by training. He was the first chair of our department starting in 1918, and was a biologist by training, but had worked with in England with at a time when there was a lot of interest in eugenics and in mathematical models of biological systems. He spent time as a postdoc with Carl Pearson and then came back. And so there was a lot of interest in modeling population growth and biological systems. And he and Lowell published numerous papers about logistic models for growth. I'll show you one of those in a second. As David said, he invented the so-called ED50, the dose at which there's a 50% response in toxicologic experiments. With Margaret Merrill, he developed the abridged life table, which was really an early forerunner of survival analysis. And I'll be showing you a little bit about the Reed-Frost epidemic model in just a second. This is a paper from the National Academy of Science that Raymond Pearl and Lowell Reed wrote, and they at some point figured out that logistic models weren't very good for describing how things grow because they grow asymmetrically. And the predictions of the asymptote, which was often of interest, was really determined by the inflection of the growth early on, and they didn't like that. So this was one of their early papers that introduced the idea of a cubic model that didn't have the symmetry early and late in the growth curve. He was also a wonderful educator, Lowell Reed, and he started a course, Introduction to Biostatistics, in around 1918. And the first I have evidence of this course was about 1923, when we have pictures of students in laboratories with these early calculators trying to compute probably to invert matrices or something. But But I also found copies of the lecture notes that Margaret Merrill, the person who followed him teaching this course, had from Introduction to Biostatistics, and it unfortunately isn't very dissimilar from the one we teach today. It was different in the sense that as you went from the front of the notebook backwards, it was all biostatistics. If you turn to the back and work forward, she had her list of people to whom she sent Christmas cards and a recipe for chocolate chip cookies, which I've used and actually very much enjoy. So Lowell Reed was well known as an outstanding teacher. He also had a number of students who did things we will remember. Joe Berkson is the most best remembered for his Berksonian error in measurement error models. And he was very active in continuing education. So if I could, Ben, could you try to get that thing to play? And I think it's channel 4. And you can see him doing a little continuing education right here. This is showing the Reed Frost model. Three colors of bead for at-risk people, infected people, and people no longer susceptible. That's Lowell Reed's hand. Anyway, that's if we could go back now. Thanks, Ben. This was on WABC in New York. There was a show, sort of epidemic models or something, and there was a Lowell Reed. One of the nice things about his having been an administrator for so many years is he gave lots of lectures, and in those days, lectures used to be written down and then published. And so if you searched on Lowell Reed, you could find lots of what he said at these sorts of lectures. And so I've chosen four quotes from many just to give a sense of what he might have thought about biostatistics today. This was a lecture he gave to the American Public Health Association honoring one of his students, W. Thurber Fales, who was the chief statistician for the city of Baltimore for many years. And Baltimore, one of the early health departments, and one of the most successful health departments in its day. And I'll let you read, but just let me say a couple things. He appreciated the administrative use of vital statistics and the responsibility of the statistician for supplying the health officer with current statistical information. And it was at a time in public health when statisticians not only analyzed data, not only designed studies, analyzed it, but they actually measured things. They were out in the field collecting data and actually responsible for the measurement process. He wrote a piece about on the publication of Sir Bradford Hill's new textbook in medical statistics, and I'll let you read again. But he said it in the middle there. His success is largely due his being Bradford Hill's success in this book is largely due to the fact that he employs a wealth of medical illustrations and gives his explanations in terms of these examples rather than in mathematical language. And remember that Lowell Reed was a mathematician by training. The real strength of the book comes, however, from the interpretive discussion of results and emphasis on the logical principles basic in the reasoning. And contrast that with his editorial about Fisher's design of experiments, which came out. He said, the concepts and methods have all the beauty that one so often finds in pure mathematics. Considered, however, as an expression of applied mathematics, they seem to this reviewer to place too much stress on refinements that lead to the greatest efficiency in the analysis when the conclusions that are to be drawn are very strongly influenced by assumptions and judgments on which the analysis is based. One may wish that the author had devoted more attention to the methods by which the scientist may check the effects of some of the necessary assumptions. So there weren't very many people got away with criticizing R.I. Fisher in those days, but Lowell Reed seemed to have done so. He wrote this last piece I'm going to share with you on specialization in biostatistics. Specialized statistical techniques for handling the data have developed, and this has led to real specialization of statisticians themselves. Staying within the field of the medical field, we now have specialists in hospital statistics and quality control and bioassay and so forth. The degree of specialization within medical statistics is in fact somewhat similar to the degree of specialization within medicine itself. And then he goes on to say that this is illustrated by Professor Cochran, and this is Bill Cochran, who was the chair of biostatistics after Lowell Reed at Johns Hopkins. He relates the story that Cochran's experience when his daughter broke her arm. A call to the general practitioner met the response that he did not handle children but suggested a pediatrician. The pediatrician, when called, said that he treated children but not set bones and suggested an orthopedist. The orthopedist said he did set bones and asked which arm it was, to which Professor Cochran, taking no chances, asked, "Which arm do you set?" So he also had a bit of a sense of humor. So I chose those quotes to point to three things that Reed might have spoken about had he been here today. The importance of statisticians collecting data, of being at the forefront of measurement. The importance of statisticians asking the right questions and challenging assumptions where necessary. And the importance of promoting transparency of both the ideas used in analysis and also of how the analysis is conducted. So I've chosen to illustrate these three ideas that I think would have been central to Lowell Reed's thinking in terms of three data analysis examples that I'm aware of and didn't necessarily have anything to do with, but I just wanted to tell you about. So the first one is about getting your hands dirty and getting involved with measurement. And everybody knows today that the field of statistics and the field of biomedicine is being revolutionized by biotechnology that enables us to measure more quickly than we'd ever done before biological systems. So this is a picture of an Affymetrix gene chip, and you can see. Actually, can you see? If you don't mind for a second. So this is just a set of what are called oligonucleotides, small RNA strands that are attached to a glass slide. And there's about, these days there's about 500,000 of them there. And there's a single strand there. And then what you do is you take a sample of tissue and you bring it in, and it has RNA in it, and it binds to the RNA strand that has the same base pairs that it has, right? And the RNA that you introduce has labels on it, and then you can measure how much of a particular RNA there was in the tissue. And remember, RNA is just the Xerox copy of the DNA that then goes out and templates for making of a protein. So it's like knowing what's being copied in the library. If you could keep track of every Xerox copy that was being made in the library, you'd know what people are doing there. And the same idea is being used here for genetics. So Affymetrix made this first technology. And one of the things they were worried about is when you had a strand of RNA here that's maybe 20 base pairs long, maybe some other strand which is similar in its sequence would bind to it even though it shouldn't. And so what they did is they had the so-called perfect match. This is what you want to catch on the RNA. And then they made a version of it called the mismatch, which is the same exact sequence, except in the middle they exchange one of the base pairs. And so what they're thinking is that if something that shouldn't bind does to this one, it'll also bind to this one because they're so similar, right? And but the ones that we really want to catch are the ones that are the homologs of this one, and that's what we're going to measure. So the way they measured in their thinking, the way they measured the binding of interest was the perfect match binding minus this mismatch binding. So this was supposed to be what you want to catch, and this is stuff that looks like it that we want to not catch, and so we'll take the difference as our measure of the amount of RNA that we were looking for. And what they do is they have several copies of this on the gene chip, and then they take a robust estimate of the mean, and that was the measure that was published with the original literature. Now, this slide is just to remind you that even though the technology is very sophisticated, the people who make the technology aren't necessarily so sophisticated, and it's good as a statistician to be slightly distrustful of what your biochemistry friends. Actually, these are some guys in our biochemistry department who run the happy hour on Friday afternoons. They're very good, very good biochemists, and this was some Friday afternoon, I think, before happy hour. So this is the typical plot that you get from gene expression data, and on the x-axis is shown the average expression for two samples. And actually, the way this experiment was done is the same sample was split into two bits, right? So we really have the same thing in both samples. And then what was done is we added some RNA to one of the samples that wasn't in the other sample. So this is a so-called spike-in experiment. And what's shown here is 1, 2, 3, 4. There's about 17, I think, oligos for which we added RNA. And those are the things we want to be able to find because that's the only thing that's different between the two samples. Now, this is a commonly used plot in the analysis of gene expression. This is just the log of the product from the two samples. This is a measure of how much RNA there is for that oligo. And this is the log of the ratio. This is how much more there is in one than in the other. And so what we should see in this plot is everything right along the line, no matter how much there is, there's the same amount in both samples. Everything should be right along the line here, except for these oligos which have been spiked in. And you can see those are shown in blue and green, and they do stand out some, except everything else stands out a lot as well. And so there's a lot of noise in the system. The measurement isn't very precise. And a colleague of ours, Rafael Irizarry, and his student Ben, and others have looked at this data, and they got their hands dirty and went back and found out how these measurements were actually made. And it turns out that correcting for this mismatch doesn't do very much correction for bias, but introduces enormous amount of variance. And so they developed a simple method that uses the mismatch data but smooths it out a lot more. And basically what they calculate is the expectation of the log of the ratio for the two samples given the information that's available. And there's a smoothing that goes on here. It's not hard to do, but which makes a huge difference. And this is what you got from Affymetrix, and then this is what you got from paying a little bit closer attention to the measurement error. And you can see now that the oligos we want to identify, this is how far away they are from their ranks in terms of distance from the horizontal line. You can see they stand out here where they don't stand out at all there. So the moral of the story here is to not, and by the way, this is the data that most statisticians started with, which is the sort of published gene expression data. But here's what you get when you go look to see how they measure the data and do a little better than the company did originally. Get your hands dirty. Focus on measurement. The second thing that Lowell Reed might have said would be to ask the right questions and challenge the assumptions. So this is the one of the main roads into Baghdad, and you're being welcomed in several languages. And there was a survey that was actually honored here yesterday, done by Gil Burnham, a colleague from Baghdad, his graduate student Shannon Ducey, and a colleague now at Columbia, Les Roberts. And they went and did a survey in Iraq trying to estimate the amount of mortality that's occurred before and after the invasion. And they estimated in the survey published in 2006 in The Lancet that as of July 2006, there had been 654,965 excess deaths as a consequence of the war, with a confidence interval 400 to 950,000 excess deaths. You must admire the degree of precision with which this is reported. But I was told by Gil when I questioned that the journal insists that we'll not put zeros there. This report was basically dismissed out of hand by both the United States and the British governments. They just did not believe what was published. And there was this cartoon, Danziger cartoon, baloney, it's only 65,000, a mere comma. So I want to just step back and talk a little bit about asking the right questions. So this is a colleague of ours at Johns Hopkins. Her name is Moni, and she stands here with a barrel that's filled with some unknown number of candy kisses. You can see there are silver and gold candy kisses. Anybody know which one has the almonds in them? The gold, that's correct. Very good. And now, if this were a philosophy lecture, and it is not, but if it were, we would probably, the next 3 or 4 minutes would be discussing whether there exists a true number of candy kisses in that barrel or not, or whether it's ever knowable whether how many there are. And I just make that point because you might ask the question, is there a true number of deaths that occurred in Iraq as the result of the invasion? I think most people would think, well, you know, it's sort of a hard concept. So we might even just focus on the total number of deaths in Iraq each year since the invasion, say before and after, not worry about the excess number, but just the number. And I think most of us would agree that there were some numbers of deaths in Iraq. So with the philosophy aside, let me just say that I was interested in what people believe about science and the value of personal beliefs in quantifying issues like how many people died in Iraq. And so George Bush and Tony Blair and others, many others, don't believe this estimate that was made by Gil Burnham and his colleagues. So I just thought it would be useful to find a little bit more about what people do believe. So I asked people the question, how many candy kisses are in this jar? And this jar sat in the front of my office for about 3 or 4 months. And I invited people who came in. This is in the biostatistics department in a outstanding school of public health. Lots of statistician types and counters and thinkers came into the office, and they were invited to guess how many candy kisses were in there. In fact, they were invited to give an interval estimate, not a point estimate. So this is a picture. The true number, by the way, is 1,626 kisses. And one of the things you learn by experiments like this is that at least every one of the 10 bags of candy kisses that we counted twice had exactly the same number of candy kisses in it. So a pound bag of candy kisses has exactly the same number of candy kisses in it. There are different numbers for the gold than for the silver, but every gold bag was the same, and every silver bag was the same. And here's what these statistical experts said. They, by the way, would win the barrel if their interval covered the truth and was narrower than anybody else's. So this is what they said. Now, just let me tell you, the median guess was 975. The truth was 1,626. So the median was 40% below the truth. Now, mind you, I watched they counted a lot. They sat there and they went like this, and they sort of put their arms here and here, and they looked around. So it's a little better than it is at trying to guess the number of people who die in Iraq, in the sense that it's a closed physical system. You can actually put your arms around it. You can sniff it. A lot of things you can do to it. And so you can see that even with 73 people, their median was a lousy estimate. And only 6 of the 73 covered the true value. So what do I take away from this? Two things. First of all, experts don't think, actually expert opinion, even the average of a lot of experts, isn't always a very good estimate of what the truth is. And secondly, that experts tend to think they know a lot more than they really do about problems. I mean, just look at the size of these bloody intervals. You know what I mean? I mean, there's a lot of confidence expressed there. So it speaks to the value of humility in science.
But Scott, you know, people probably know that they get too wide intervals.
Well, I know. I cheated. But so you caught me. You caught me. Very good. But I'm going to do the experiment again. Anyway, so let me just say that there is some real data about this Iraq question. And one group, the Iraq Body Count out of England, actually monitors newspaper reports, radio reports, and then has investigations about the mortalities that are reported in the media. And back when this paper was published, their estimate was of media reported deaths was 48 to 54,000. That's not a statistical interval. That's whenever there's a discrepancy about how many died, they took the lowest value and the biggest value and came up with on the order of 50,000. An order of magnitude less than was reported in that Lancet journal. So, you know, one of the interesting questions is, what do we want to know? So one thing is nothing. And there's this quote by General Franks who said, when asked about an earlier version of this study, we don't do body counts. And actually, I think that was the most honest treatment of the problem. because it is reasonable that the military does not want to get in the business of counting casualties. They do count their own, but it's not their business to count other people's casualties. And so one of the things you might say is, well, we don't do this. Another thing you might do is say, we want to know the number of civilian deaths, or we want to know the number of violent civilian deaths or violent deaths. And then what this paper was about was the number of civilian deaths by violence in excess of what would have occurred absent the U.S. invasion. So that's a counterfactual idea. Had there not been an invasion, how many deaths by violence would there have been? How many were there with the invasion? And the difference is what we might want to know. So the point, obviously, is that it's a lot harder. It's a lot easier to say how many total people died. It's harder to say how many of those were violent deaths, because then you have to have cause material. And then the hardest thing is to say how many deaths were actually caused by the U.S. invasion. So going from the top to the bottom is a really increasing difficulty. But let me just focus on how many people die each year in Iraq. What do we know about that? Well, I was able to find three reports from the U.S. government saying how many people die each year. And the numbers that were reported were from these three sources for 2006, 144,000 deaths, 227,000 deaths, and 296,000 deaths. That's not for the number caused by the invasion or the number of violent deaths, just for how many people died in Iraq in a one-year period. So it's a very difficult problem. So that led this group from the School of Medicine in Baghdad and from Johns Hopkins and from Columbia to actually go do a survey. And I think this would be something that Lowell Reed would have taken to heart. He did many surveys himself in East Baltimore, looking at various aspects of health and morbidity and mortality there. And I'm not going to go into the survey in detail, but let me just say that they divided the country into geographic clusters. They randomly sampled the clusters. Within the clusters, they took a random sample of subclusters, and then within subclusters, they took a random street and house and did all of the houses within I think 40 houses within, nearest to the one that they chose at random. They used a GPS system for this, choosing the random start place in 2004 when they first did a survey, and then in 2006 they were afraid to use GPS because it looked like it might be a bomb, and so they just did this other method with choosing a random house. They had a medical team of a woman and a man go to each house and ask a questionnaire, and they got information for the period January 1st, 2002 until the date of the interview. They inquired about how many people were living there at the moment, and then they recorded all births and deaths since January 2002. And when there was a death, they had the date of death, the reported cause of death, and if it was reported as a violent death, they obtained details about how the death occurred. They asked for when there were deaths for death certificates in 87% of the people they interviewed, and in among that group, 92% of the 87% produced a death certificate. They sampled 47 clusters, a total of 1,849 households, 12,801 people, and they recorded 629 deaths. This is the histogram of the numbers of deaths for each of those clusters. And here's how those data turn out. Before the invasion, they have a 13-month period. There were 82 deaths reported there. 2% of them were violent, and the crude mortality rate is 5.5 deaths per 1,000 persons per year. And that, by the way, is very close to what was reported by the CIA in one of those three numbers that I gave you. The leading cause of death was reported to be cardiovascular disease, and there was this is violent mortality rate, very little, you can see almost no violent death. And then post-invasion, a 39-month period, there were 547 deaths, 302 of which were violent. And the mortality rate went from 5.5 up to 13.2. The leading cause of death was gunshots, and the violence mortality rate was 7.2 per 1,000 per year. And this just shows the age and sex distribution of mortality. So those of you who know demography know that this thing is supposed to look like this, like the female mortality looks, right, with greatest rates of death early and then late in life. But what's happened there is it's sort of been turned upside down with more deaths among 15 to 45-year-old men who are involved
in the violence. And you can see that very much so in the violent deaths. And so they reported rates of death by pre-invasion and then three post-invasion 13-month periods. And the green curve is just the crude mortality rate. And then the red curve is the difference between what the rate was at the baseline, right? They've just taken the change from this baseline to that second point and plotted here as this red dot, right? And so that's the, quote, excess mortality. They took the baseline as the initial, as what would have occurred had there been no invasion. And this is a plot that shows the likelihood function for the numbers of deaths that they reported, which has its peak at around 590,000 excess deaths. There it is, 654, sorry, with that interval. And interestingly, they had done a study in 2004, and they consulted with me before they did this 2006 survey, and I thought that for this to be credible, they had to go back and get the data again from the 2004 population and be able to compare the same clusters and be able to compare what they saw today, because I thought that there might be telescoping in what when people remembered deaths. Anyway, here's the results from two independent surveys with different households. They didn't have this one because that's from 2004 to 2006, but you can see there was quite a bit of consistency. Now, one of the things that they've been criticized for, and I think it's a reasonable criticism, is the following. This interviewer saying, scientifically speaking, how many Iraqis would you say have died since the invasion by the blood-sucking axis of Anglo-American imperialists cluster-bombing baby killers? And so, you know, this idea that somehow this is self-reported mortality data and maybe it's been biased by the surveyors and maybe it has. Anyway, I chose this example because there was a lot of discussion about this and no data. And so here's some people went and actually collected some data. They've been, you know, roundly criticized and have given it back as good as they got it. But I think Lowell Reed would have been very proud to have had this study come from his school because they were asking the right questions and challenging the otherwise unchallenged assumptions. And then the last example I want to turn to that I think Lowell Reed would have been interested in it is this idea of making what we do as statisticians as simple as possible. You know, he criticized Fisher for being mathematically precise but focusing more on mathematical detail and praised Sir Austin Bradford Hill for, you know, giving illustrations and simple explanations of statistical ideas. And so I'm going to use this example of mortality and air pollution that I've been very fortunate to work with my Hopkins colleagues in the audience on for the last several years to illustrate this idea of transparency of ideas and methods. So this is a picture in December 1952 of London. This is 12 noon London, and you can see that the air pollution was quite thick that day. And if you plot mortality before, during, and after that that smog event, which was about a week long, people estimate, that there were approximately 10,000 excess deaths over the next 3 months. So there's no doubt that air pollution causes premature mortality. And the best, what was surprising, however, is in about in the late 80s, early 90s, Joel Schwartz and Doug Dockery and Arden Pope and many others started seeing signals of mortality, excess mortality, even with air pollution at the current levels, which are about an order of magnitude less than they were in 1952 when that picture was taken. So we've dropped air pollution from that those days was about 3,000 micrograms per cubic meter of particulate matter, and now we're in the range of about 150 would be a bad day. So we're about 20 times lower. But people started picking up signals that there still is excess mortality associated with air pollution. So there's two kinds of studies that have been reported in the literature. There are studies that look at how much mortality there is in one city as compared to another that have different amounts of pollution. Yeah? And then the problem with that study is well, that's a good study because it looks at sort of long-term exposure. You live there, I live here. Who's at higher risk of death? Because you've been living in that air for a long time. Huh?
The trouble is, people who live in one city aren't necessarily otherwise similar to people who live in another city. And so you're having to compare across populations. So to check that, what people have done, he said, okay, well, let's go to one city and let's look across time in that city at higher and lower polluted days and see if we get more deaths on the higher polluted days. It's the same population of people, so there isn't this bias from different characteristics of the populations. And so, but this kind of a study can only look at acute exposures because everybody's been chronically exposed to the same air, right? You're only looking at the effects of short-term exposures. Let me just say that both of these studies find evidence of an association. These studies find evidence of bigger risk than these, as you might expect, because these guys, you're controlling for whatever their long-term exposure was. So here are the two main studies, the so-called six city studies, which were organized by Harvard, and the American Cancer Society study. And I'm not going to go into the details, but let me just say that the mortality relative risk for all causes of death was about an increase of about 16% in the six city study and about 7% in the American Cancer Society study. And here's the data from those two studies. So this is the data that gives the 1.12 rate I reported. And here's the data. You're fitting a line there for the 1.07 rate. So you can see there's not a lot of cities in the six-city study. How many cities were there, do you think? Six. That's exactly right. And there were about 50 cities in the American Cancer Society study. But that's the basis of evidence that we have. Now, just before we go any further, let me say that I was on an Institute of Medicine panel that was looking at these methods, and I think I remember the number, about 10,000 excess deaths, if the air pollution estimates that we get from those chronic exposure studies are right. And so we ought to put this into perspective. That's 10,000 excess deaths as opposed to about 400,000 for smoking per year. But nevertheless, this is an open question, and the EPA is required to protect population health, and so they need to know whether there is a health effect at the current levels. And so we undertook a study called the Medicare Air Pollution Study, or MCAPS, and it's a study of 50 million people who are covered by the Medicare system, and there are about 2 million deaths per year in this population. And we went and got all of the pollution data. There are about 327 locations where we have pollution monitors that measure particulate air pollution. This is particulate matter that's small enough to get deep into your lung. And what we did is we sort of matched up the people with their air pollution monitors and undertook a study to see if we could replicate what was found in those two studies. So here's the bottom line of those studies. We see, remember I said 1.07, so I've just gotten rid of the 1.0, and now it's just showing that as 7, right? So if you take all ages, we get, for different ways of correcting for various things like SES and smoking, which we have to correct for with using COPD incidence data, but you get about 7, which is sort of like what was found in the ACS study. And we get much tighter intervals because we have 2 million deaths per year. But how do we get that? Well, you get that by doing some big complicated model. And so the question is, are there simple ways to make pictures that will let people see what's going on? So one of the ideas, and so just going back here for a moment, where does this come from? It comes from comparing, say, this monitor in the Northwest, which has got very high pollution, with this monitor down here. Where is it? Low pollution. Probably over here. No, or maybe here. With this monitor in the Midwest, right? And this is low pollution, that's high pollution, and we look at the mortality rate here and compare it to that one, right? But we do that with a sort of a model, a log linear model that's got lots of other things in it. But in the end, you're basically comparing across populations. And one of the things that comes up is, gee, you know, is there anything else different about people who live up in this part of the country than the ones who live over here? And maybe, you know, maybe we, if we could, we, what would we do? We would compare people who live here with people who live there but under lower pollution exposure. You know, if we could run the counterfactual experiment to sort of see what happens and then do it again without any exposure to pollution, we would look at the difference in the mortality rate. So one of the things you might think about is that maybe the degree of cultural and other differences increases the further cities get apart in some measure of distance. It could be distance, it could be some covariate distance, but what we'd want to do is compare people who are as similar to each other as possible, except for having different pollution levels. So that's an idea that we tried to put into place. So
what we've done is we've taken and we've just calculated a log relative risk for City J and City K. So we're going to compare two cities. This is the mortality rate for City J divided by the mortality rate for City K. So that's the relative rate, right? And here's the log of the relative rate. And then we're going to divide that log relative rate by how different the pollution was. That's pollution in City J and City K. And so this is sort of like a regression coefficient. It's the change in mortality per unit change in air pollution, but calculated just from two cities. Right? And now, those two cities are some distance apart in a space that's defined by some covariates U. So this will be actually geographic space in what I'm going to show you, but it doesn't have to be. So I now have a relative risk for every pair of cities that are a distance D apart. And so the idea then is to sort of, and what I'm showing you down here, see these numbers changing? That was the 7, right? It's sort of hard to see, but I'm comparing cities that are close to each other. 175, 200 to 225, 225 to 250, 250 to 275. So these comparisons are cities that are a fixed distance apart from each other. And then what I calculate are all of these, the average log relative rate. So we can actually see the extent to which the results we get in that national model comes from comparing cities that are very far apart or comes from comparing cities that are closer to each other. And I can actually summarize that little movie with a graph. So I've done it separately for the west, central, and east part of the United States. And here's the estimate of the log relative risk when cities are within 10 miles, 10 to 100 miles, 100 to 250 miles, 250 to 500, and more than 500 miles apart for each of the three regions of the country. Right? And you can actually see that, and this is for 65 to 74-year-olds. So you can see that they're pretty consistent, actually. They don't change too much. Right? And actually, the west estimates are somewhat smaller than the estimates in the other parts of the country. And then when you go to the older people, actually, it's interesting. You get sort of an estimate that's about half as big overall, but now you see quite a dependence on distance. So when you restrict your attention to cities that are pretty close to each other, like, say, within 100 miles, well, you don't get a very big effect. When you go out here further, you have more information, obviously, but you get an effect that's a little bit different. So the idea here was to try to decompose the effect a little bit into effects estimated at different distances, so hopefully we can make the findings a little bit more transparent. The other aspect of this is not to just show people where do your estimates come from, but to be able to replicate those estimates. The best kind of replication is where somebody does the whole thing again. Right? Now, unfortunately, with Medicare, you can't do all of Medicare again. Because you only got one Medicare and you're only ever going to have one. So you can't have you could have a separate investigator of the same data, but you can't have separate data, right? Separate study. You got the same data, you got different analyses maybe, and maybe different methods used for those analyses. And so my colleague Roger, who will be speaking in a minute, has developed this idea of, well, if we can't replicate everything, at least what we have to do is make things reproducible, make the data analysis and software used available to people so they can redo things. So all of the data from the work that he has done is now available on the web, and it's all available in R packages. And the idea is he's now working on problems that maybe he'll tell you more about when he speaks, looking at how to make the data available so that someone can redo your analysis easily. You have a paper, it says that the log relative risk is such that there's a graph. You want to be able to touch that graph and have the data come up in the software. Maybe they want to change the program and do it a little bit differently to see how the result changes. So finally, transparency, by looking at observational data from many perspectives and by encouraging others to look as well. So let me close by saying the main points. Lowell Reed was an early giant in American biostatistics. He was an outstanding scientist, a great educator, and a very prolific administrator. He administered everything there was to administer at my university. And if he were here today, I think he might tell us to get our hands dirty by focusing on how things are measured, by not being afraid to ask the hard questions, the right questions, and to challenge people's assumptions, and to the extent possible, promote transparency so other people understand what you're doing and can ask the hard questions themselves. I want to acknowledge that most of this was not my work, and work of all of my colleagues that are, so many of whom are in the room now, Francesca and Roger and Holly
and I want to thank them for making their work available, and thank you for your attention.
Well, it's been a treat for us to hear and acknowledge such wonderful accomplishments of so many wonderful people today. Thank you so much for your attention and your time today to join us for our award session. Now, we have another session coming up. We have a 30-minute break, and then we have the Spiegelman session that's coming up in 30 minutes, and we'll have speakers there. So we invite you to come back and hear that. After that, we will have a business social in this a combination of a social event and reception, as well as a business meeting for people who are members of the section and would like to contribute to thinking more broadly about where we're going with the section. So that's from 6 until 7:30, I think, or 7:15. And then I invite any of you who would like to join us for dinner. We're going to dinner. We have reservations and probably can add a couple of people, Amy, if we can. Amy Donaldson or me, if you'd see either of us, we'd be happy to add you to the list. I think, what's the name of the restaurant?
Oyamel.
Okay. So at any rate, thank you all for your attention. And again, thanks to our awardees for your contributions. And we continue to look forward to more contributions. Thank you.